Our second case for argument this morning is Javier against Milwaukee.
Good morning. May it please the court. We're asking the court today to reverse the district court and to remand this case for a limited new trial on the issue of scope of employment. And we're asking for that relief because the district court here made three critical mistakes of law. Number one, he failed to instruct the jury that a police officer can misuse his authority or use unreasonable force and can still be acting within the scope of his employment if he was performing a duty that was delegated to him by his employer at the time of the act. Number two, the district court's failure, that first failure I told you about, was compounded when the district court then also failed to prohibit the jury from using criminal charges that were filed against the police officer for the use of force to find his actions outside the scope of employment.
Why were those charges admitted, the evidence of those charges admitted in the first place?
The charges were admitted. We did not contest their admission as long as they were admitted with proper limiting instruction.
Why did you make that concession?
There were multiple reasons for it. First of all, it was relevant to the sequence of events in the case. The police officer had been cleared in an inquest, subsequently charged, later suspended, so it helped with timing.
What difference does that make?
It made a difference because at the time we went into the case, we were putting forth a ratification theory that we didn't know wasn't going to be accepted until the end of the case. We didn't want the city to be able to come in and say, we suspended the officer without the jury knowing that they only took that action in terms of sequence after he was criminally charged. There was another.
Well, the criminal charges were issued by the district attorney's office, obviously, and had nothing to
correct.
Do with whether the police department ratified this shooting or not, and the ratification theory has no application here anyway.
And I will address the ratification theory. I want to address one other point in reference to criminal charges, and that is that in this case it was highly publicized. It was in the paper significantly because of its unique facts. We were seriously concerned that the jury would already know of the criminal charges or would remember the case as they heard the evidence, and because of the prejudicial potential of them, we thought it was critical that they come in with a limiting instruction that the district court would tell the jury they could not consider the criminal charges on scope. And the district court had given us every indication that that's what he was doing. And, in fact, in the decision where he denied the new trial, he thought that's what he had done.
Right. No, I'm aware of that. And I've read the confusing record that is at issue here. And there were mixed signals that were sent. But it seems to me that the evidence of the charges that were issued against the officer should never have been admitted in the first place, although your point is well taken that if it was to be admitted at all, it should have been admitted with a limiting instruction about how it was to be considered. But I don't see the relevance on either, certainly not on the liability issue here, and it's extremely prejudicial. And it has no relevance whatsoever to the scope of employment issue either and is prejudicial on that as well.
And we agree it's prejudicial, and the problem is that we were led to believe the jury was going to be told something that they were not in fact told. So when we said, okay, the criminal charges can come in, we thought the jury was going to be told, number one, the criminal charges do not take the officer's actions outside the scope, which is exactly what Your Honor had just said, and number two, an officer can misuse their authority and still be acting within the scope of employment. And he didn't make that point either. The limiting instruction that we had asked for made both of those points. And the scope of employment instruction that we had asked for also made that point about misusing authority. And the problem with the judge not doing that here is if you look at the record, he gave a color of law instruction that specifically told the jury that a misuse of authority can be within the color of law. But the scope of employment instruction did not say the same thing. And this was a jury that noticed every detail. They asked a series of questions about the form of the instructions. One of the questions related to the misuse of authority language, so they had keyed into that. They found that the use of force was unreasonable. They knew the officer had been charged criminally for the use of force, but nobody ever told this jury that that doesn't mean the officer is outside the scope of his employment. And the points of law that we asked for were clearly correct statements of the law. The district court didn't find otherwise. We have, on the scope of employment question, decisions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court and from this circuit that make clear, particularly when you're dealing with a police officer, that you have to make sure that the jury is focused on the nature of services the officer provides as opposed to the outcome of the act. Because if you do anything other than that, as soon as the jury finds the use of force is unreasonable, the jury, as laypeople, not knowing the law, can conclude, well, he used too much force, so he must not have been within the scope of his employment. The district court here never told the jury that. The district court, the failure of that was compounded by the color of law instruction, and the fact that the use of force here was rejected by the jury, I think, shows the prejudice. Because this was a jury who awarded a huge sum of damages, $1.85 million, evidencing that they clearly thought what the officer had done was wrong. So to not tell the jury that the law is you can be outside the scope or you can misuse your authority and still be within the scope of employment was clear error that tipped the scales in the favor of the city. That was compounded, and I agree with what Judge Sykes had just said, when the city was then allowed to use the criminal charges, as they did in the closing argument, to point out to the jury several things. The city said that the city's interests were not served by murdering someone. Very inflammatory language. They said that the situation dealing with their officer changed when the criminal charges were issued. They said that the chief of police needed the facts before she could do anything to the officer, and that those facts came when the DA's charges came down. All of those things were told to the jury in the closing, and yet the last words that were said by the district court here were that the jury should not substitute the DA's charges for their own decision in the case. I'd like to direct the court to the district court's decision where he denied the new trial. And what the district court said there is that the court's instructions made clear to jurors that they could not conclude that Glover, who is the officer, being criminally charged necessarily meant that he was acting, that he was not acting within the scope. He said that the jury was told that the criminal charges could not be used by the jury in any way in deciding the scope question. But if the court would look at the limiting instruction that the district court actually gave, he said none of those things. In the instructions that he gave on the limiting instruction for scope of on the criminal charges, he didn't say anything at all about scope of employment. The words scope of employment aren't even in the instruction. Additionally, he didn't tell the jury, as I already pointed out, that a misuse of authority or the issuance of criminal charges don't take the officer's actions outside the scope of authority, the scope of his employment. So this jury was allowed to then go deliberate, knowing the facts as they did, again, because we believed that the best way to deal with the prejudicial risk of these facts was to make sure the jury knew about them and to be properly instructed on them. And that didn't happen, and it is grounds for this court to reverse this determination on scope of employment, to send it back to the district court to have a retrial where two particular instructions are given to this jury. Number one, misuse of authority or unreasonable use of force can be within the scope. And number two, the criminal charges, if they are admitted, must not be used by the jury in deciding the scope of employment question.
It's really unclear to me why there was so much evidence admitted in this case about what happened after the shooting. You know, apart from the officer's testimony at the inquest, which was obviously relevant to the scope of employment question, and perhaps on the underlying excessive force liability as well, everything else that happened in terms of this officer being placed on desk duty and, you know, what the police department did and didn't do after the fact is completely irrelevant.
And, Your Honor, what the evidence came in for important reasons. First of all, how the department treated his actions after the fact, this district court found correctly, I think, was relevant to determine whether they were within the scope in the first place.
Why?
Because the department itself never questioned what he did. There was also all of the evidence, because we were in the unique position here of an officer who was no longer before this jury. The officer had killed himself. We had to read in testimony from the inquest. All of the evidence that came in, the vast majority of it, came from the inquest. Exhibits were from the inquest. All the witnesses had testified about the inquest. So what had happened, since we didn't have two witnesses that were there anymore, the police officer was dead and Mr. Prado was dead, everything that happened afterwards is what was used to show what happened that night. And there was no way around it because of the unique position we were in.
The inquest testimony would have been sufficient for that purpose. I'm talking about the evidence pertaining to what the police department did and didn't do with regard to Officer Glover's employment. All of that is irrelevant, as are the criminal the issuance of the criminal charges.
I disagree that how the department treated his actions after the fact were irrelevant. This was a department who gave this officer workers' compensation benefits for an on-duty injury at the time of the incident. This is a department that knew all of the facts that then they were going into the jury and saying this was a private event where the officer had a personal motivation and this had nothing to do with it. But that was impeached by the fact that he remained on the force. He continued to have his powers to use his gun. He continued to act as a Milwaukee police officer. And so it refuted the theory that they were advancing to the jury in the case. And I've noticed that I'm in my rebuttal time, although I'm happy to answer additional questions.
Well, I don't think you are, because I don't see a light on. But I'm still not satisfied by that, because, as I said, the ratification theory doesn't apply here. Ratification theory operates to impute to the employer, for vicarious liability purposes, an act of an employee that is committed outside the scope of employment. And that's not the scenario we have here, where there would be that kind of imputation for vicarious liability purposes. This is an indemnity claim under a statute, and it requires for indemnification that the act be committed within the scope of employment. So that separate common law doctrine about ratification and vicarious liability just has no application here at all. And so I really question the decision to litigate this case on the basis of all that occurred with regard to Officer Glover and the police department afterwards. Some limited aspects of that might be relevant. The workers' compensation claim might have constituted an admission by a party opponent that this was an on-duty injury that Officer Glover incurred. That might be relevant, but the rest of it really isn't. And this should have been confined to the evidence of the circumstances of the event itself to determine, under the applicable legal standard for scope of employment in Wisconsin, about whether the officer was acting within the scope of his employment. What happened afterwards doesn't really matter.
And the course of dealing between the employer and the employee, both beforehand and afterwards, and afterwards, we believe likewise, the course of dealing shows whether or not the employee was acting within the scope at the time of the act, because this department treated this at all times for 15 months as an action by a police officer. They never took any different position. They didn't even take the simple act of taking his gun away. He got workers' compensation benefits. There is no way to divorce in this particular case what happened afterwards from what happened before, because all of the evidence that we had, because we had two deceased people, had to come from the department's investigation. And so to try to put this case together in some kind of context without looking at what happened afterwards, I think would be virtually an impossibility.
What's your position in response to my question about the ratification issue? You've raised that on appeal as well as a claim of error.
And we did raise that as a claim of error, because we believe there's no reason that the common law doctrine of ratification cannot be applied to the indemnity statute. Olson, Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, specifically says that you can look to the common law in interpreting 895.46, the indemnity statute.
For purposes of the scope of employment definition.
And scope of employment, though, can include acts that are within the scope or acts brought back within the scope because of the employer's ratification. And I further see that I actually am now
That's
really
That's not how that common law doctrine of ratification works. It doesn't make those acts within the scope of employment. It simply imputes them to the employer for purposes of vicarious liability.
It brings the acts back within the scope of employment.
It doesn't. All it does is say that there is vicarious liability if an act committed outside the scope of employment is, in fact, ratified. It doesn't mean that those acts were committed within the scope.
And it's our position that there's no reason that that doctrine cannot apply to the indemnity statute. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Smokowitz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. On behalf of the City of Milwaukee, we ask the Court to affirm the judgment of the lower court below. And in an attempt to answer many of Judge Sykes' questions of Ms. Senatori earlier, I believe that, or I would submit, rather, to the Court that Judge Callahan in this case attempted or allowed much of this evidence into the case out of an abundance of caution and effort to try to address the issues raised by Ms. Senatori. In other words, I would submit, Your Honors, that if he erred in that regard, he erred to benefit the plaintiffs rather than certainly the city. In this regard, I think perhaps he was struggling a little bit with the jury instruction here from Wisconsin on this pure Wisconsin issue of scope of employment and the instruction to the jury in general that an employee is within the scope of his employment when he is performing work or rendering services he was engaged to perform and render within the time and space limits of his authority. The plaintiffs contended below, as they contend here, that acts afterwards were relevant to that kind of consideration. We would submit that they are not, but they were entered into evidence nonetheless, I would submit, for that purpose.
Even acknowledging that, to the extent that what occurred afterwards with respect to Officer Glover's employment, the issuance of the criminal charges should never have been admitted here as evidence. It's highly prejudicial and completely irrelevant.
Your Honor, we argued, obviously, in our brief, and we argued below that there are a couple of bases to bring in the fact of the charging. Because some of the other evidence that was going to be allowed in was going to be allowed in, Chief Hegarty was going to be asked about suspension. And why did you suspend Glover at a certain time, 14 months after this whole incident? And the answer was going to be, the truthful answer was going to be, that was when the charges were issued. I would agree, Your Honor, that in the absence of that kind of element, one of the reasons for introducing the evidence would be gone. However, there was another reason to put in the evidence, and then we've argued that as well here as below, and that has to do with Glover's credibility. The jury was hearing from a dead man. We were unsuccessful, incidentally, in putting in any evidence about his suicide. That was excluded. And so the jury was hearing from a dead man, and the question that obviously was there was, well, was this credible or not? And we had no ability to cross-examine. However, the evidence of context, what was his context of testimony? And that was a criminal inquest where he was attempting to show, to explain, and to establish that his actions were justified, lawful, and those of a police officer.
Right, and all of that came in. You know, the context of his testimony came in, right, that it was in the context of the criminal inquest?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, so what possible relevance does the district attorney's decision to charge have, and how is that not highly prejudicial? Well, and the way it was used in this case, highly prejudicial.
Again, Your Honor, it was not, I would submit it was not misused, first of all. It was used.
Well, you argued to the jury that the city does not authorize its officers to commit murder.
And that's a fine line, Your Honor, but the point of it would be this, that in such a situation, they are authorized to use force, but they are not hired to commit murder. They are not hired to kill their spouses.
Right,
they're
and
not
telling
hired to kill
the jury that the officer was charged with murder allows you to make substantive use of the evidence of those charges in a way to defeat the scope of employment issue under the indemnity statute. That's a substantive use of that evidence, not a course of conduct use, not a, you know, complete the picture use. It's a substantive use of that evidence. Highly improper, and it's in particular improper without an appropriate limiting instruction.
A couple of points on that one, Your Honor. First of all, it was, of course, merely a characterization of the action. It was not made in context or in connection with, if you review the transcript of my argument, it was not explicitly tied to the charges. Number two, the judge...
How could the jury not...
Well, but number
link
two,
those things
the
up.
Judge did give an instruction, a limiting instruction. He told them that they are not to have their judgment substituted by the district attorney's
decision.
Yeah,
that's totally meaningless under the circumstances.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that that's consistent with the White decision from the Eighth Circuit that in evidence, when it's introduced like that, of a determination by an agency to take an act that's something, a probable cause determination, for example, in a Title VII case, can be introduced. Limiting instruction is you have to make your own determination, and they were entitled to make their own determination.
The problem here is the jury was not told how it permissibly could use this evidence. It was given this vague instruction about, you know, don't let the DA's decision to charge this guy with murder affect your decision, which... It's just, in my judgment, a meaningless thing to say to a jury. But more importantly, the jury wasn't told, once this evidence was in, how it could permissibly use it. And so, effectively, it could use it for any purpose whatsoever.
Well, a couple of things, Your Honor. First of all, no objection was made to the argument that
to the admission of the evidence, but the
or to the argument that I made. In other words, there was no objection made at that time of the argument that I was going beyond or that at that point a limiting instruction beyond what they had asked for or were told.
That doesn't matter at this point because the issue on appeal has to do with the jury instructions and the verdict form in this case. And the jury was not instructed on an appropriate basis how it could use this evidence and what the scope of employment means in the context of a police officer accused of using excessive force, which is what the substantive claim was here.
The other point, though, and the other problem with that is one that Judge Callahan noted in his decision below, which is he did not want to overemphasize this issue for the jury by giving those kinds of instructions. And this does fall within the scope of his discretion there. He did hear all of the evidence. He heard the way it came in. He heard the fact that there was minor fleeting reference to these charges. If you bring them back again and you put the proverbial neon sign over them in the instructions to the jury, the concern
that evidence was damaging enough on its own, the fact that the officer was charged with homicide and perjury. Okay? It's inflammatory. Let's put it that way, without an instruction.
Counsel, the sort of argument you're now making is the plaintiff didn't know what was good for her, right? If the district judge had proposed to give an instruction highlighting the use of the indictment and the plaintiff had objected, one could easily see why. But you're now saying the plaintiff wanted an instruction, but the plaintiff's lawyer didn't know what was good for the plaintiff, and therefore the magistrate judge was helping the plaintiff out by denying this request for an instruction. That doesn't seem very plausible, does it?
Well, it's the only reason that Judge Callahan gave, and it does, given the fact that Judge Callahan was, once again, we would submit, allowing the plaintiffs to get into areas of evidence that
How long were the instructions in this case? How long did it take to either number of pages of transcript or time it took to give them to the jury?
Your Honor, I believe the instructions are at least a portion of them.
Yeah, well, a portion of them won't answer that question.
I'm sorry. It is just a portion of them. In this first phase of the trial, I would say approximately half an hour, Judge.
It seems to me, as a legal matter, it's self-evident that in a scope of employment case, or where there is a scope of employment question, and here it's statutory, it's not common law, and the context is a claim of excessive force by an officer, the jury has to be told that, as a legal matter, and there's plenty of case law support for this, both in the Wisconsin Supreme Court and here, that this the officer's misuse of his authority or excessive use of force is not itself enough to make that act or to take that act outside the scope of employment, that the scope of employment issue is not decided based on the outcome, that is, someone is injured or someone is fatally wounded, but that the context of what the officer was doing is what determines the scope of employment issue, and the jury has got to have that law in order to properly evaluate a scope of employment question in the context of an excessive force claim. Otherwise, it's intuitive to infer that when the officer uses excessive force, that by definition takes it outside the scope of employment, and that's not the law. But that's what most lay people would assume is the law, and unless the jury is told otherwise, it's going to make that intuitive assumption.
But I would submit, Your Honor, a couple of points on that. First of all, I would actually argue that the inference would go in the opposite direction. In other words, juries are familiar with the fact that officers can use force.
They're certainly familiar with that, but they're not familiar with the concept under Wisconsin law of scope of employment. That's lawyers' talk. Now, what worries me about a case like this is whether lawyers' talk is adequately expressed in lay language for jurors. Right? I worry when somebody proposes to give a limiting instruction because that's almost always more lawyers' talk. But we need to be sure that the judge explains a technical legal concept like scope of employment in a way that jurors can understand. And I view that as the central question here. Was that done? If you look at all the instructions together, was there a clear explanation for a layperson about what scope of employment means in Wisconsin?
I would submit that the two pages of instruction which are reproduced in the plaintiff's appendix and which do constitute the scope of employment instruction does that, Your Honor. And I would submit that
What in that instruction conveys the concept, which is, I think, important, that in fact that the use of force was excessive does not take it outside the scope of employment. The critical question here was whether Glover was acting as a police officer or as a vigilante.
Right. Well,
that's a very difficult thing to make, but you can be excessive as a police officer or excessive as a vigilante.
Well, I think that, Your Honor, it is encapsulated in that very first sentence on page SA-24 of the third paragraph. An employee is within the scope of his employment when he is performing work or rendering services he was engaged to perform and render within the time and space limits of his authority and is actuated by a purpose to serve his employer in doing what he is doing. There was ample evidence, Your Honor, and there was expert testimony submitted on behalf of the plaintiffs in this case and argument about it, that what he was attempting to do was enforce the law, whatever that was, and that he just went too far. That's exactly what they've argued in the brief here. The jury understood that, and they would understand that in this context better than if you go back to one of the cases they cite, the Manol case from 1927, I believe, where a jury dealing with a collection clerk who beats a woman up, allegedly, according to her testimony, they find that, nonetheless, to be within the scope of employment. That would seem to be highly unusual. And yet a jury was able, in that context, to reach the conclusion about scope of employment. I can't say what the jury instructions were in 1927, Your Honor, in that case, or Your Honors in that case, but in point and in fact, the jury was well-armed in this case by all of the testimony, including testimony from
What's the instruction that you've been referring to the pattern jury instruction in Wisconsin on this issue.
I'm sorry.
Was that the Wisconsin pattern jury instruction?
It was, Your Honor.
How does Wisconsin make pattern jury instructions? Are they the work of linguists, or are they the work of a bunch of lawyers?
Well, they're work, as I understand it, of a committee that includes judges and professors from the University of Wisconsin Law School.
The law are created by committees. We, of course, are a three-person committee. Small committees are better than large committees.
This instruction hasn't been updated for a very long time, isn't that right?
I can't say when the last time that was updated, Your Honor. It probably has not been updated, certainly for within a period of a number of years. On the other hand, I don't know that there's any authority for the proposition that in this particular type of case, it needs to be updated or modified to address the particular concerns raised.
The instruction committee hasn't taken up the subject of whether the scope of employment instruction should be updated to account for claims against police officers for excessive force, which is, you know, it's a not infrequent kind of a claim. They've never considered doing that.
As far as I know, I have no authority on that one way or the other, Your Honor. However, I'm sure the court is well aware, state courts in Wisconsin have concurrent jurisdiction. Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Ms. Senatore? That's guaranteed. Your time is short.
I believe I have about 30 seconds. To answer your questions, Judge Easterbrook, there was no clear explanation given about what scope of employment means when you're dealing with a police officer. Nothing in the instructions conveyed to the jury the concept that a misuse of authority or the unreasonable use of force could still be within the scope of employment. The pattern instruction was given unmodified. I believe in 1994 it was updated to account for gender language. It doesn't say anything about a police officer authorized to use force, and the committee itself said in drafting those instructions that it must be emphasized that in very few cases will it be possible to use these instructions verbatim. The district court used instructions verbatim here in a very unique case. He said it was a hard-fought case. It was. We didn't get a fair fight. We'd ask the court to remand and to have a limited new trial on scope of employment. Thank you.
Taken under advisement.